fallen in this country's wars, that there will be no veterans of any further war, not because all shall have perished, but because all shall have learned to live together in peace. And to the dead here in this cemetery, we say they are the race. They are the race immortal, whose beams make broad the common light of day. Though time may dim, though death has barred their portal, these we salute, which nameless passed away.
President John F. Kennedy speaking on Memorial Day 1962 from Arlington National Cemetery. Memorial Day, of course, is a time to honor those who've given their lives for this country, and not just those who died in battle. Timothy Allen Isolink had been a captain in the U.S. Army Rangers. He completed his service, and then he went to Iraq as a private contractor to supervise a mine-clearing project. After completing that contract, he returned to his home in Namibia, and soon after, he shot himself in his home in front of his wife. He had a 3.5-year-old daughter and an 11-year-old stepson. It was April 23, 2004. Now, a decade later, his mother has written a memoir about her son. Janet Burway is a novelist and poet. I spoke with her in April and began by asking her to read the first few lines of her book for us.
Every suicide is a suicide bomber. The intention may be absolutely other. A yearning for peace, the need to escape, even a desire to spare the family. Nevertheless, the shrapnel flies.
Is there an anger that you had at his suicide at first when you learned of it?
Yes, but I don't mean to be expressing that anger with that shocking first passage. It's the shock. So it's the shock of learning that this terrible thing has happened. My anger was widespread at the NRA, at the gun culture, at the company that he worked for, and so forth, you know, and at him for taking that route in his trouble.
He was 40 years old. And tell us about him when he was growing up. By your account, he was really attracted to the gun culture and to the military.
From the very beginning, he was, as a toddler, loved the planes and tanks and armored cars and G.I. Joe guns of the army culture, and also had a powerful sense of justice and what's right, and even sometimes what's appropriate. And as he grew up, he attached himself to the army idea of the warrior spirit very strongly, and that seemed to express and contain his sense of honor.
And this was not the kind of attitude that you had. So you talk about how you two had very different political philosophies.
Very different. I am not willing to call myself a pacifist because I haven't been tested, but I don't see that wars have much use. That, you know, if we sit a family down and say, you know, you guys are warring, you've got to learn how to get along, we don't do that with nations. We say, hang tough, you know. And I have always been on the side of diplomacy.
You wrote, though, that you came across an essay that he wrote as a freshman at the University of Michigan, talking about you. And I wonder if you could describe what he wrote in that small essay.
It was very moving because there was some anger in me clearing his things out of the attic and finding that he had stashed 26 guns in my attic, you know. But as I went deeper into the belongings that he'd left, I found this essay which was about coming home for Christmas and how coming home to Tallahassee really was coming home for him because his mother had let him find his own path and we could therefore be friends. He said something that not all kids can say. So, you know, I think it was true that he and I understood that we did not share a worldview, and that we had the task as mother and son to love each other without sharing a worldview. we were able to talk about that. So it was hard for me to have a gun-loving son. It was hard.
Mm. But he went to Iraq, and he did something that he thought was worthwhile and helping the people there. Can you tell us what he was doing in Iraq?
Well, yes, he was training 160 Iraqis in mine removal, and they had gone out and cleared land from partly from mines that the Iraqis had sowed, but partly from American cluster bombs that were lying around. And they had cleared land for soccer fields and schools and for farmland. And he did feel very positive about both about his men and about the work that he was doing. But he came home angrily disillusioned about Bush and Bremer, who was running the coalition, and about especially his company, whom he thought overcharged the government and was corrupt in its practices and careless of its men.
So he finished out his contract. He returned home to to his home in Namibia.
Right.
And then what happened?
Well, it's not entirely clear. Of course, it's not clear what was going on with him. He did seem to have a lot of the symptoms that are included in the diagnosis of PTSD. He was hypervigilant. He was sometimes very lost, looking into the middle distance for periods, and sometimes irrationally angry, sometimes irrationally afraid. A psychiatrist afterward suggested that he had had PTSD, but his wife sued the government for, or rather the insurance company, for benefits, and she lost. It's very hard posthumously to prove PTSD.
There is, in your book, a preface written by a clinical psychiatrist who specializes in PTSD, and he says that those servicemen and women who aspire to live these American soldierly ideals can be soul wounded when they discover that these ideals are not being lived up to by others. And do you
Jonathan Shea uses the phrase moral injury, which I think is so exact for what happened to Tim.
And I wonder, could you talk a little bit about that? What do you mean by moral injury?
Well, Shea describes it this way. He says that if you are a soldier out in the field and you have a strong sense of right, and people who join the Army voluntarily often do have this strong sense of what's right and what's wrong, and then you find that your superior officers are giving you orders which you are bound to follow but which you know are not right, you are totally trapped. Trapped.
Did you see that sense in him growing up as a child, that he had this deep moral sense of what's right
Absolutely.
And what's wrong?
Absolutely. He was the most fiercely honest and honorable child you ever ran into. I didn't know where it came from. There was a time that the boys, Tim and his little brother Alex, discovered some professional bows and arrows in the woods. They were in a box that was addressed to a local sporting goods store. And Alex and I kind of looked at them kind of, you know, greedy. And Tim said, we have to take them back right now. And we took them back to the sporting goods store. And they had been apparently intended for a civic community sports center. So it was Tim who had this powerful sense of what the right thing is to do, you know.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Janet Burraway. She's written a new memoir, it's just out now, about the death of her son. It's called Losing Tim. And it's been 10 years since he died.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, you are a writer, you've written many books of poetry and you're a playwright and also a novelist. And I'm just wondering, did it take you 10 years to be able to write this book, to try to understand what happened to Tim?
Well, I began to write almost immediately. And the first writing was mainly in my journal and little essays about my grief and it's my anger and the difficulty of carrying on. Most of it was in my journal and just flashed down. I think all writers feel this to some extent, that writing is the way I make order out of the chaos of life. And so it was natural for me just to write about it. But at some point, it began to seem to me that there was a book in it that might help other people. Last week in the New York Times, I read that there are 22 veterans a day killing themselves. That means there are 22 mothers a day in the position where I was. And I myself had been enormously helped by books about suicide, about depression, about the Army, and I began to see that there might be a helpful book in this. I started writing it maybe 8 years ago, and I went back to it and back to it and back to it until a couple of years ago, and finally felt that it was in a form that I could say, this is the truth as near as I can come to it.
Well, you write that you tell your students, your writing students, that the end of the story is the most important part, that it's the last sentence that echoes backward through all the rest.
Yeah. It's hard not to feel that about Tim. I think one of the most difficult periods for me was shortly after his death, when I was, my husband and I were beginning to get back into a kind of social milieu. And at the dinner table, somebody would tell a funny story about their kids, and somebody else would tell a similar story. And I had a story to tell, but I couldn't tell it because it would kill the conversation, because the end of my son was suicide. And so I'm past that now. You know, now I could, his childhood is his childhood to me, and I can talk about it. And in fact, it's very good for me to talk about him. I feel his presence a little more when I'm talking about him. But for a period, that was very difficult.
Well, do you worry, or did you worry when you were writing this book that, you know, this was your way of creating order, understanding, and meaning, that in the end you might not really get to that? You might not ever really understand what drove him.
I did worry about it, and I think that's the case, that I came to an understanding that I can live with, but I don't fool myself that I really understand what went on in his mind. We can't, you know, and I think in the family of a suicide, everyone must try to understand what happened. I think it's a natural impulse. Why? Why did this happen? But it's not really something that can ever be answered.
Well, as a mother, you must go over everything and wonder, what did I do? Yeah. What could I have done something else?
Yes, 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 yes. You know, there's a rational plane upon which I said, it's nobody's fault. It none of us did anything intentionally to hurt this young man, you know. But under that, everybody feels guilty. What did I do? What could I have done?
What about the shrapnel 10 years later? How has his suicide affected you and his kids and his wife?
Well, of course, it's a continuing terrible loss, an enormous hole in our lives. But there is also something else, which is the way you learn that family and friends gather and rally to solace you. One of the strange results of Tim's suicide is that I've become close to his stepmother and his half-sister. And she, his half-sister, said when we first got together, you know, we would never have known each other at all if this hadn't happened. And then somebody said to me early on, you don't get over it, you learn to live with it. And that's really what happens. You don't get over it. You don't entirely heal. But as another a mentor of Tim's in the Army said, the skin grows over the shrapnel, and you rarely feel it, but when you do, it still bites.
Janet Burraway, her new book is called Losing Tim. And Janet, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story today with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
There is a lot more ahead on Press Play in just a moment. We'll be back after this.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When GQ magazine recently heaped praise on downtown Los Angeles and the New York Times said it was one of the top places to visit in 2014, there was this collective moment here in LA of, well, tell us something we don't know. Downtown's been having a moment for several years now. It's got a lot of cool bars, hip restaurants, edgy art galleries, and a whole lot of people who were there before all that stuff showed up. For our series, Fault Lines, where we look at the income divide and everything in between, we went to a place downtown that captures this change. It has people creating the new downtown and people who are being left behind. The Spring Arcade Building bisects the block bounded by 5th, 6th, Spring, and Broadway, pretty much the dead center of downtown. The arcade is a gorgeous reminder of what downtown used to be back in the 1920s, a Beaux-Arts indoor shopping promenade with a sparkling glass atrium and ornately decorated storefronts, most of which are empty for now.
So what's happening here now?
We're finishing construction. You want to come in?
Yeah.
Husband and wife Uli Nazibova and Ryan Valancourt spend most of their waking hours inside one of those storefronts, putting together what will be, in a few weeks, Gelateria Uli.
We're going to have 16 flavors every day. So we're going to have stracciatella, we're going to have chocolate, vanilla, pistachio. And we're also going to reserve one or two spots for something more inventive, such as beet tarragon. It's incredibly delicious.
Uli quit her job as an investment planning analyst, and Ryan left his job as a reporter for the Downtown News. They cleaned out their savings and started to look for a space to open their gelato shop. And they found it in the Spring Arcade Building, practically in their backyard.
One of the reasons why we love living downtown is we love seeing these gorgeous, beautiful architectural gems be brought back to life. Right where we're standing right now used to be a street, actually, between Spring Street and Broadway called Mercantile Place. And 100 years ago was the busiest commerce street in Los Angeles. This is where everyone came to shop.
This one block?
Yes. And what developers of the day decided, well, why don't we build two towers, one on Spring Street, one on Broadway, and connect the two with an arcade, turn it into an indoor mall. So this happens to be one of the oldest, if not the oldest, indoor mall in Los Angeles. And in its heyday, it was the place to go shopping. It was one of the busiest places in Los Angeles.
Really?
Yes.
Because now it's pretty much empty.
Yes.
After the building's heyday and downtown's, times got tough, and the arcade reflected the economic decline of the area. In the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, the arcade was filled with swap meet-style stalls, people hawking discount toys, knockoff purses, luggage, electronics. Those stores have gradually faded away, except for a few, including one directly opposite Uli and Ryan's gelato store. It's run by a man named Tom. He didn't want to give his last name.
Madeline, nice to meet you.
Tom opened his business more than 20 years ago, but a lot has changed since then.
Many of our customers, they lost their jobs, and so they don't spend the money. That's why the owner of this building, he doesn't want no more like this kind of old style, like swami kind of business here. Yeah.
He doesn't want your kind of business here.
No. That's why I need to go. Yeah.
Are you really thinking of leaving?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Business is going down and down.
How do you feel about that? You've been here for more than 20 years.
how I feel, kind of hopeless. Sometimes you feel hopeless, sometimes you get, what else you can do, you know?
What do you think when you see something like this gelato shop coming in, and this is kind of a luxury item?
I know. I think this is a city they want to change. I think this is the future, I believe.
Where are you from? Where did you come from?
I'm original from Taiwan.
So when you see Uli, who's also an immigrant, do you see yourself in her 20 years ago?
Yeah, pretty much. She's so excited. When I first time opened my business, I was so excited too, yeah.
You were excited?
Yeah, excited, yeah. But I think that she make a good decision. I think it's a future, yeah.
Tom, like the Spring Arcade building, is a symbol of the changing downtown. Uli Nazibova and Ryan Valancourt, symbols of what's next.
So what kind of other stores do you think will come in here? Do you know?
Mm-hmm. So there's a crepe shop down the way, Crepes on Frontier. Guisados Tacos is opening either this month or next month. Another high-end restaurant, as well as an English pub, Royal Clayton's, that used to be open in the Arts District.
Yeah, and so there are a few other stores here. They're mainly selling T-shirts and, I don't know, toys, cheap toys, and swap meet stuff.
Yep.
Yeah?
Yeah, several of which it's been kind of fun, you know, becoming friendly with some of those shop owners who are still here.
So is there any tension, though? Because when you have more higher-end stores like yours, like a gelato store, then maybe the landlord thinks, oh, we can raise rents because they're charging more, they're bringing in a higher-end customer, and then maybe Tom across the way, who sells cheap T-shirts, five for a dollar, can't survive. Is there any tension there at all, or any worry on your part about that?
Well, there sure isn't tension with us and Tom. We love Tom. Whenever we come to work, sometimes we bring our dog, and she always runs over there, and Tom takes care of her, gives her treats. I think the reality is, you know, over the past 5 or 6 years, as you can see, the place is mostly empty. You know, so it's not really a narrative of displacement. It's just change.
Uli, Ryan, and Tom spoke with us as part of our Faultline series looking at the income divide here in Southern California. Since we talked to them in February, the gelateria has opened its doors. Coming up, we meet a woman who was one of the best street photographers of the 20th century, but no one had ever heard of her until a few years ago when a young man in Chicago happened upon a box of her negatives. We'll have that story after a news update here on KCRW.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In 2007, a Chicago man named John Maloof bought a box of photo negatives at an auction house for around $400. The box turned out to be a cache of incredible street photographs from an artist no one had ever heard of. She worked as a nanny.
You'd see her on her little motorized bicycle. I mean, I remember sometimes thinking she kind of looked like the Wicked Witch of the West.
Always had her camera around her neck. Always the camera around her neck.
Her name was Vivian Meyer, and since discovering her photos, Maloof has gone on to be Meyer's champion. He's printed and archived thousands of her photos, created 2 books on her work, and he organizes gallery shows around the world. Now, John Maloof has made a movie, along with co-director Charlie Siskel, about his journey to find out more about this mysterious and talented woman. It's called Finding Vivian Meyer. But before we talked about her story, I wanted to know what makes her work so great.
You know, it's really hard to pinpoint because she took photos of so many different things in different places and different types of content, you know. So she could capture a moment that was seemingly like staged and it's real. So there's a street scene with two women walking in stride on the sidewalk. There's a man waiting at like a bus stop looking in like profile. And then there's this windowsill with these two little kids with their arms crossed out the window. There's a little girl sitting on a stoop and a boy rolling a white wall tire. In the middle of the tire hole is like perfectly where the girl's feet are and the stoop. It's like centered perfectly. And he's running with this tire. And there's another window open and somebody else is in that window. It's like the perfect, it looks like it's staged. Like she paid all this money to set the scene up. But it's all real and it's captured in like 1/250th of a second. And to do that is really hard, mm-hmm. you know?
Did she take a whole bunch of photos?
No. Oh. Rarely. I mean, she did here and there, would, you know, take a few in a row. But usually, because she was so frugal and she didn't have much money to, you know, process or buy film, she would just take one shot of one person and then move on. This one, I think, you know, I really can't say for sure because I don't remember that strip of negatives, but I think she did take a couple. But not more than like three, I would say.
So she is in the tradition in the mid-20th century of a Robert Frank or a Deanne Arbus.
Right.
Gary Winogrand, like mm-hmm. those kinds of photographers who really made it an art, elevated street photography to an art. Helen Levitt.
Yeah.
But nobody knows her name. Well, they right. do now because of your documentary. But before that, nobody knew who she was.
Right. But her photo that's being compared to a Deanne Arbus predates Deanne Arbus's photo. So, but I think she was self-taught. She went to museums and saw exhibits and bought books. And I think she just was well aware of what was being done. But she had no feedback on her work at all. And she was doing this, most of it, she was not even seeing the photograph printed, only in negative form. And a lot of them, like thousands of rolls, she never even processed. So she saw the scene in her camera, took the picture, and then that was the end of it. And she did this for her whole life. And to be able to do that for so long without having anybody validate you, give you criticism, or any feedback at all, or even seeing a lot of the work that you're making is pretty remarkable.
So she never had a show.
Oh, no.
And it appears that she didn't want that. It was not like she pursued it and people rejected her. She didn't want it at all. She didn't seek it out.
You know, in the film we have, I find a letter that was written in French to a lab. It's written in pencil and there's like corrections in it and it's ripped out of a notebook. So it looks like a draft. We don't know if she ever made the real letter and sent it or if it just like ended there. But we do know that there was work done with this lab before to make postcards of her landscapes of the French Alps, because I have them. And that's what she's talking about, you know, moving forward with something. But it never, you know, materializes, and we don't know if it's because something happened to her or we don't know.
So everything that we do know is because you decided to go find out who she is. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any scholarship on her or anything written about her before.
No.
So what a detective story.
Yeah.
And then you got really interested in finding all of her negatives.
Her work was inspiring me to become a photographer. And I had an emotional attachment to the work, so I thought, I want to piece together all of her archive as much as I can. So I went to the auction house, found out who bought the other boxes, and I bought their boxes, and I started to reconstruct her archive. Of course, this
is... How many prints are these?
Well, I mean, altogether, there's about like 100,000 negatives that I was able to acquire of her archive, and maybe 3,000 prints that she made, mm-hmm. and now there's even more stuff because I found one of the families that she worked for as a nanny, and they were going to throw out all the stuff of hers out of a storage locker, and I just said, I'll just take it. So I have all of her stuff, like 8mm movies, a bunch of her cameras. I have like her coats and hats, and like there's like receipts and like books and mail.
And she didn't have any family to leave that to?
No.
So she was this singular mystery woman
mm-hmm.
who was single and who lived this very isolated life, yet was surrounded by people, took care of other people's children, and yet had this other passion.
Yeah, she had the life that she wanted, I think, because being a nanny, she was able to go out and take photos and have the freedom to do that, even with the kids. So she'd take the kids to see movies or, like, you know, whatever, and she would go take photos with these kids. And there's a lot of stories that they have of their memories of that.
She would take us down to the city, and we would just walk in the worst parts of town.
She'd take pictures of everything.
We would joke about how we wanted to hit her over the head with the camera because she embarrassed us so much.
My mom put her foot down and wouldn't let Ms. Meyer take me into the slum areas.
But, you know, she also didn't really have a permanent address, being in that type of employment, you know, so she's living in homes of other people. She went by aliases. She changes her name in every family, a variation of the ways of they what to call her, if it's Miss Meyer or Miss Myers or Viv or Vivian or whatever. It's always different. So, you know, something's going on. I don't know what it is. She definitely wanted to be under the radar.
How did you first crack the case as to who she was? What was your first clue that she was a nanny?
I found an address on one of her things, and then and I got a phone number. I called them, and I said, you know, I have all the negatives of a woman named Vivian Meyer. I'm just wondering if you have any idea who she was or whatever. And they said, oh, that was our nanny. And I was like, what? That was your nanny? That was, this person is taking all these photos. I have 100,000 photos. How can this person be a nanny? And I said, you know, there's a lot of photos of children. I'm sure I have some of you as children. Like, I would love to meet with you. I'm happy to give them back to you. And I gave them so many back, prints and negatives and stuff. And they were very grateful. And they said, you know, we consider her a mother. In fact, more of a mother than our own mother. She was around that often. But we just don't know anything about her. We don't know anything about her past. We don't know where she came from. She never told us anything about that. So that was like when I said, I'm going to make a documentary.
It's so interesting that she was able to capture the details of other people's lives so accurately and yet was so unknowable herself and refused to give anyone any details of herself.
Yeah, and I think that's why I've accepted the fact that although Vivian would not be extremely happy about a documentary exposing her, you know, her flaws among her, you know, praises and whatever. She did this to other people. You know, her whole life was documenting other people. She did movies about, you know, her 8mm movies were documenting stories that she found was interesting. She was using audio tapes to interview people. She clipped out stories out of the newspaper obsessively. So this is a story that she probably would have clipped out if she saw it, you know, and I think that she would even maybe, you know, want to investigate it further. And so I think she would understand, you know, this is another story, and it's something, you know, that I'm documenting about you now.
And so you own all the negatives, and you are also have made a documentary about her, which is increasing her value because it's making her well-known now. Do you stand to gain financially?
The story that a man buys a box for $380 and contains 100,000 negatives is not true. I bought one box that was 30 to 40,000 negatives for $380, and the rest of it was almost 100,000. And I spent the last 6 years archiving.
Oh, $100,000.
Yeah, $100,000. I'm
not
sorry.
Negative.
There's a lot of hundred thousands mentioned. So anyway, and you know, just to give you an idea, scanning the work in was $100,000. Just scanning the black and white work. And there's still work we can't afford to process, like the color rolls of film. Anyway, it's a lot of money. We haven't made, the archive hasn't made money yet. But when we do, Charlie and I in the gallery have actually, not when we do, we're doing this now, started a endowment for at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago for women who want to go into the arts. So it's like a scholarship. Every year it's going to be forever. It lasts forever. It's going to be in Vivian's name. And so, yeah, there's obviously something to gain, but we are going to be doing the best we can to make sure that we give back. And if, you know, I'm sure it will make something someday, but right now it's not.
What is her reception now in the art world?
At first, you know, when I was contacting all these institutions, including MoMA and Tate Modern and ICP and Eastman House and Center for Creative Photography, people were just wanting to wait a little longer because they're like, who is this kid that found this work? Sure, there's 100,000 images. What is he selecting? is it really that good? You know, so they wanted to wait to see if it really, you know, the full body of work that she did is actually good, or if I'm just selecting the very, very best out of a tiny amount of good work. And I think it's slowly winning over those critics and institutions. I'll see what happens. You know, we'll see what happens when the film comes out. I think little by little, it's people are coming around.
So you spent a lot of time tracking her down and trying to figure out who she is, mm-hmm. or who she was. Of course, you never got to meet her. What if you did get to meet her? Would there be? Is there a question that you really are dying to ask her if she just?
Yeah, I mean,
popped
I think
up right now and.
I would like to know, I mean, it would be hard to face her at this point after all this work I've done, you know, but I would like to know, I'd like to have a conversation with her about, you know, what she thinks about how I'm, you know, if she's okay with what I'm doing with her work.
Wouldn't you want to ask her why she didn't make it her full-time job, why she continued
to nanny? Oh, I'd have more questions, of course. Yeah, I have a ton. Like, why didn't you show it?
Yeah.
Why did you not show it to anybody? How did you learn to be such a good photographer and so quick?
Yeah.
Because she was, like, really good right away. So, yeah, and then, you know, what happened with your family? Why is there this big disconnect with your family? And why didn't you go see your mom when she died in 1970-whatever in New York?
When did she die?
2009.
Mm-hmm. And you started this in 2007.
I bought the box in 2007.
Right.
And I started, you know, being...
So she was around
she
for
was around.
2 years during your
keep
the beginning
in mind,
of your quest.
Yeah. Okay, so keep in mind, the book, I bought the box end of 2007. And I probably took it out mid-2008.
But do you kick yourself now?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, like, because if I would have just, like, tried a little harder, I would have probably been able to find her while she was alive. But at the time, you know, it's all relative. Like, people think... Oh my God! It must have been a giant eureka moment that you picked this box up and you looked at it. No, because every photographer has a ton. Most of their work is bad. Seriously, every photographer. So you pick up a negative sleeve, and you're not going to be like blown away. There may be one good shot on that roll. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you have a eureka moment. It takes a while to learn what you have. It was such a long, long process. This mm-hmm. whole thing. Everything took me a lot of time to learn as I went. I was not a photographer and I was not a critic and I had no background in this. So I had to learn as I went.
John Maloof, he directed a new documentary called Finding Vivian Maier. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Coming up, a closer look at the meat market. We find out why Tyson Foods employs a Hunger Games style competition for local farmers and how that affects the chicken on your plate. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and now we're going to talk about big meat. Just a handful of companies control most meat production in this country. Take, for instance...
Tyson Chicken Nuggets. They're crispy on the outside, juicy on the inside. Made with 100% all-natural ingredients.
Mom, please!
They're the one thing kids love, 100% of the time.
Thanks, Mom!
Tyson Foods. It's the biggest meat producer in the country. Not just chicken, but pork and beef, too. And with size comes influence. Christopher Leonard is the author of a new book called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you describe what a modern chicken processing plant looks like?
Sure. It's an enormous facility that might cover several acres of land, and it's tremendously sophisticated. When you walk inside, you see these huge conveyor belts carrying chickens that are slowly disassembled by a line of workers and then shunted into giant ovens that turn them into tenders or chicken nuggets. And they'll be shuttled to other lines where they're prepackaged and then sent to giant frozen rooms where they're stored and then put onto pallets and put onto trucks, which will then take them to Walmart distribution centers, McDonald's distribution centers, and to the grocery store.
And so this is basically a technological marvel, but you're saying that the meat industry really looks old-fashioned in the sense that it is, for all intents and purposes, a monopoly.
That's right. In fundamental ways, when you look at the structure of the business, we've gone back in time 100 years. Back in the early 1900s, the meat business was controlled by a handful of companies that were known as the Meat Trust back then, old school companies like Armour and Swift. Well, today, the business is even more consolidated than it was back then. In other words, a few companies have even more control over the market than the Meat Trust did. For example, just four firms make over 85% of all the beef in the United States. Just three companies make almost half the chicken. And they control the business in a way that old companies only could have dreamed of doing.
So describe what they do. They have the eggs, you say, and then they sell the eggs to the farmers who then raise the chicks?
They don't even sell them, to be honest. Yeah, here's how it works. Tyson Foods, it owns a giant hatchery, and it owns a feed mill and slaughterhouse and truckee line, everything you need to raise birds. And it will hatch the chicks itself, and then a Tyson truck will deliver these baby chicks to a giant factory farm. Now, the physical farm itself is owned by an independent contractor who will raise the birds for Tyson Foods, but Tyson owns the birds the entire time. The farmer never actually owns the birds. And Tyson will come and then pick up those chickens in about 6 weeks when they're adults, take them back to the slaughterhouse, and then process them and sell them as the final product.
Well, why don't they just cut out the middleman and run their own farms?
Because the company realized, and other companies did as well, back in the 1960s, that really, investing in the farm was not a great use of the company's money. You had to buy a lot of land. You had to build these giant warehouses, really, where you raise chickens today. They're called chicken houses, but they're these giant, technologically sophisticated buildings that really aren't good for any other purpose, so they lose their value over time. And so executives at Tyson made a concerted decision back in the 60s that what they would do is sort of offload that investment of owning the farm and give that to the farmer and then control the process by still owning the birds.
But you describe a situation where they basically do control the farms, they don't own the farms, but they do control how the farming takes place. And you describe something called a tournament. Can you go into that?
Yeah, the tournament system really drives to the core of the modern meat industry. When I first started reporting this, I thought chicken farmers would get paid the way other farmers do, like a price per pound basis. But what a company like Tyson will do is collect a group of farmers who deliver chicks to a slaughterhouse in a given week, and then rank them against one another and pay them based on how well they did competing against their neighbor in terms of raising as much chicken as possible based on how much feed Tyson gave them. And in a way, that sounds good, right? They're incentivizing good production. But when you look at the reality, the farmers can't control the most important things that determine success in the tournament. And that's how healthy the baby chicks are and how high quality the feed is. Tyson controls that. So for the farmer, it ends up being more like a lottery. But maybe even more troubling is that it's a zero-sum game. The top farmers always take money from the bottom farmers. So even if all these farmers do a great job, they beat industry benchmarks, they are fantastically efficient, the top will necessarily win while the bottom necessarily loses. And what that means is it's effectively dividing farmers against one another to make sure they never work together, never share information, never organize, and it really keeps them powerless when compared to the company.
And so this has winnowed out a lot of farmers who couldn't make it, maybe older farmers who didn't have modern technology.
Yeah, the key component of this is, the farmers can't control the chicks or the feed, but what they can do is borrow more money to upgrade their warehouses or their chicken houses. Or, you know, they could build a whole new farm that's a little bit more efficient. Maybe it holds the heat a little bit better, for example, and then it can outcompete the older housing. So what this effectively does is it lets Tyson control the one thing it does not own, which is the actual physical infrastructure of these farms. The new farms will usually beat the older farms in the tournament. And what that does is it keeps farmers on this treadmill of debt. You know, just after they've owned the houses for 5 to 10 years, they might just start being to clear a little bit of money on the houses, but then they need to borrow more to upgrade because somebody new is competing against them in the tournament.
It's kind of weird that it's called the tournament. It makes me think of the Hunger Games.
Yeah, I mean, chapter 5 of the book is called Cage Match, because that's really the reality in rural America. I mean, as a business reporter, to be honest, it's kind of one of the saddest things I've ever seen. I mean, you've got these farmers who are independent producers, they're entrepreneurial, they want to stay on the land, but they're forced to compete against each other in a game in which they are totally disadvantaged.
Is this also happening in the cattle and hog industries?
It's fascinating. So the system we're talking about here is called vertically integrated production. You know, the chicken business is completely vertically integrated. There's no open market anymore for chicken. Now, the pork industry is a little different in that these big companies kind of pioneered contract pork production and took over most of the pork industry during the 1980s and 1990s. I called it the Great Chickenization. It's when they really replaced open markets with contract markets. But what was fascinating to me was that these hog farmers who have these big contract hog farms up in Iowa, their contracts were a little bit better than the chicken farmers. For example, there was a farmer I interviewed who grew for Smithfield in the hog business, and Smithfield put these farmers in a tournament, but the farmers still had an option of who to work with. The consolidation wasn't quite so strong in the business yet, and the farmers pushed back and actually got out of the tournament. So you'll have hog farmers in Iowa who don't have to compete in a tournament, but who get an incentive payment instead. But what's really telling is that as competition dwindles and as the contract market gains more strength over the open market, the terms of the contract start to change, and hog farming begins to look more and more like chicken farming. And the cattle business is sort of the last frontier of the independent producers. The big companies like Cargill and Tyson have never really cracked the code for raising cattle in the same way they do chickens and hogs. In other words, completely within a factory environment.
But at the same time, aren't those companies then under the thumb of bigger companies like Walmart, who buys chicken, and McDonald's, who obviously buys a lot of nuggets?
That's such a great question. And, you know, Tyson Foods and Don Tyson, who really pioneered the company, have always sort of tried to shift the attention away from them and said, hey, you know, don't look at our business practices. Why don't you look at Walmart, which is really putting pressure on us to just run as cheaply as possible and push prices down for our farmers. It's essentially not our fault how we operate. It's ultimately Walmart's responsibility. But that just isn't true today the same way it might have been back in the 1980s or even the 1990s. Again, three companies, Tyson Foods, Pilgrim's Pride, and Perdue, produce almost half the chicken in the United States. You know, back in the late 70s, about 40 companies controlled that much of the market. Today, it's three. So if I'm Walmart, if I'm McDonald's, if I'm Burger King, the menu of vendors I have to choose from that can realistically deliver tremendous volumes of meat to me at an affordable price around the clock, 7 days a week, I don't have a lot of choices. I've got Tyson, I've got Pilgrim's Pride, maybe I've got these smaller regional players that have 7% of the market or less. So, you know, the Tyson Foods of today has a market power that is really incredible and surpasses anything these meat companies might have had in the past.
And so conspicuously absent seem in your narrative is the federal government and any kind of regulation on monopoly practices or any kind of regulation on these tournaments that you're talking about and any kind of protection for the family farm?
That's absolutely correct. Again, during the 70s and 80s and 90s, there was this sweeping wave of consolidation. And the federal government at that time was completely hands-off and allowed these mergers to go through. And I think the thinking was, that these meat companies were making meat cheaper at that time. They were industrializing the process, realizing a lot of gains, and could kind of turn around and say, hey, look, don't worry about the fact that we're really losing competition in this business. We will provide meat more cheaply to consumers. So these mergers were allowed to go through that really turned the clock back 100 years and created a highly consolidated business. And now we are absolutely seeing the fruits of that. The cost of meat, when adjusted for inflation, did go down in the 80s and 90s, but then it started to flatten out. And then it started to grow in the, after the late 90s when the business really got consolidated. Now meat prices are climbing sharply. I lay out clearly in the book how these companies can cut supplies to keep prices higher, keep their profit margins fatter. But the dilemma for any antitrust regulators today is that the cow is out of the barn, if you will. It's very hard to go back and reintroduce competition to a business after you've let it disappear. I mean, these companies have millions and millions of dollars to spend in Washington. They have a group of lobbyists like the American Meat Institute, the National Chicken Council, who are just really adept at working the halls of Congress. And they did a tremendous job in 2010, 2011, of turning back the Obama administration's effort to introduce a little bit more competition into the business and pass some new antitrust reforms. It was an effort that was totally dismantled by the meat lobbyists in just about 18 short months.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing all this information. I learned a lot.
Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
That's Christopher Leonard. He's the author of The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. Thanks for joining us on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I hope you have a great Memorial Day. We'll be back tomorrow. Coming up, join Warren Olney for To the Point. That's next on KCRW.